You're listening to event audio from the Brookings Events Podcast, part of the Brookings Podcast Network. For more in-depth analysis and commentary from Brookings scholars and our guests, go to brookings.edu/podcasts or listen via Apple Podcasts or your favorite podcast app. Don't forget to follow us on Twitter at Policy Podcasts.
Good morning, everyone. My name is Mireya Solis. I'm the director of the Center for East Asia Policy Studies here at Brookings. And it's a pleasure to collaborate with the U.S.-Japan Research Institute and the Global Taiwan Institute in bringing this program to you. When we planned for this event, we knew that the topic is very timely, but I have to say we could not predict how timely it is going to be. Just last night, there was a statement from the White House, the President notifying Congress that it has reached an initial agreement on tariffs with Japan that will not require approval from Congress, and that there will also be an executive agreement on digital trade. Comments in Tokyo have been a little bit more cautious, and the comment has been more on the lines that they're still finalizing the agreement, and they would like to reconfirm that there would be no national security tariff on automobiles. So this is really, of course, happening as we speak. And we're going to devote, of course, a lot of time to these developments. But I want to take a broader view of this, and then let me provide you with some context. Under the America First banner, President Trump promised a reset of U.S. trade policy. The utmost priority has been to rebalance the economic relationship with China, especially with an eye towards addressing market-distorting policies that could give China an unfair edge in the technology race. But another important line of effort for the Trump White House has been to negotiate a string of bilateral trade agreements with the promise of delivering better access for American farmers and for American producers. For trade-dependent economies in Asia with close ties to the United States, like Japan, like Taiwan, this moment of change and disruption presents challenges, but also opportunities. The U.S.-China trade war and the increasing bifurcation of high-tech platforms presents major challenges for the Japanese and Taiwanese economies, both at the center of global supply chains and with advanced technological capabilities. There are opportunities as well, in the sense that a bilateral trade agreement with the United States offers a chance to put behind market access irritants and deepen bilateral ties. I have to note that there are important differences between Japan and Taiwan as they navigate this uncharted territory. Japan has finished two mega trade agreements, the Comprehensive and Progressive TPP, and the agreement with the European Union. And as we heard just now, it's on the verge of closing a deal with the United States, whereas Taiwan is interested in launching negotiations with the United States precisely to ameliorate its economic and diplomatic isolation. So to explore this very complex set of issues, we have a stellar cast of panelists. I'm going to introduce them very briefly in the order in which I'll ask them to come to the podium and offer remarks. And after that, we'll all come to the stage. I'll engage the panelists in the discussion, and then I do promise I'll bring all of you for Q&A and for you to share views as well. So let me start then in the order in which I'll ask them to come to the stage. Barbara Weisel is Managing Director at Rock Creek Global Advisors, and before that position, she had a very distinguished career at USTR, where she was the lead negotiator for the TPP for the entirety of the negotiations. I imagine those were a marathon 8 years. And she was also Deputy Assistant for Bilateral Asian Affairs. So I think that Barbara can provide a very good perspective of the difference in negotiating bilaterally or regionally. Shujiro Urata is Professor of Economics at the Graduate School of Asia-Pacific Studies at Waseda University. But that is, in fact, only one of the hats of Shu Urata, who has many affiliations with several research institutes, including the Economic Research Institute for ASEAN and East Asia. I should also note that Shu had a previous affiliation with Brookings in the past, and he is widely considered to be a leading authority on Japanese trade and foreign economic policy. And Jinji Chen is Dean and Professor of the Graduate School of Financial Management at the CTBC Business School in Taiwan. He's also an advisor to Taiwan's Executive Yuan, Taipei City Government, and Taichung City Government, and has in the past been a visiting professor both in the United States and Japan. So we have a very exciting topic ahead of us. We have leading experts, and without further ado, Barbara, if you can please come to the podium. Thank you.
Thank you, Mariah, and thanks to Brookings and the U.S.-Japan Research Institute and the Global Taiwan Institute. Let me apologize in advance. You can see I have a cold, and I will try to speak clearly through my sore throat. As Mariah said, it's a good time to have this discussion on relations in Asia as countries try to determine how to best manage and advance their interests in these interesting and very challenging times. I thought I'd start the discussion with some remarks on whether the U.S. can articulate an effective bilateral strategy in Asia, and then say a few words about the bilateral negotiations with Japan and Taiwan, or the potential for negotiations between the U.S. and Taiwan. And for context, I wanted to start with a very brief recap of U.S. trade policy since World War II and how we got where we are. And yes, I know we only have 10 minutes for this presentation. I want to break up this recap into four periods, at least the first three of which logically followed the one that preceded it. The first major period was that of multilateral trade negotiations, which started post-World War II with the negotiation of the GATT agreement. Subsequent to the GATT agreement in 1947, there were eight negotiating rounds that focused mostly on tariff elimination, but then successively added other issues. It started with 23 countries, and by the time the negotiations ended in 1994, the countries were up to 128 members. So the process that started out as a difficult process among 23 countries became quite unwieldy and slow and increasingly difficult to negotiate. So began the second period of negotiations and the second major period that followed this period of multilateral trade negotiations, and that was a period of more bilateral trade negotiations. This started in the mid-late 80s and continued up through 2008, more or less, and beyond, when the U.S., along with many other countries, began negotiating bilateral or small agreements as opposed to large multilateral agreements. The U.S. wanted to establish preferential trade with key countries that would advance its commercial and other broader priorities, promote trade and economic growth, and also to avoid the kind of unwieldy negotiations that the WTO had become. Underlying this was an interest in spurring multilateral negotiations, both the pace of multilateral negotiations and the breadth, the ambition level, which everyone recognized provided the greatest benefits to the most countries. But in order to do that, countries decided that they needed to negotiate these small agreements to push along the larger agreements. So the United States negotiated in that period NAFTA and 13 other bilateral and small regional agreements. They were high standard by the standards of the time. But then, as this period progressed, questions started to emerge about the wisdom of negotiating bilaterally, and whether or not the so-called spaghetti bowl of rules that was emerging from all of these bilateral agreements was creating more problems than it was fixing, and that the differences between the various agreements was making it more difficult for companies to operate it, not simplifying the system. Another problem with the negotiating bilaterally was that it was an extremely slow and painstaking process. Bandwidth issues in agencies made it difficult to negotiate more than a few agreements at a time. And even once an agreement was concluded, Each and every agreement had to be ratified by Congress. So no matter the import of the country, the trading partner, and whether the economy was large or small, each agreement was a difficult vote for members of Congress who, as you know, do not like to take trade votes. So the ratification process for each one was controversial and heated. All of this led to another rethink and to the third period that we entered around 2008, which was a rethink into the negotiation of plurilateral trade agreements, that is TPP and TTIP, which I count as a plurilateral, but some people call it a bilateral. And the vision for these regional agreements was clear. For TPP, the U.S. had four key goals. The first was to expand trade and investment with the world's fastest-growing economies, those in Asia. The second was to boost U.S. regional competitiveness. Many other countries were negotiating preferential trade agreements, both regionally and bilaterally, and the U.S. needed to do something to accelerate the pace of its efforts if it wanted to keep pace. So a regional agreement was a better way to go about it. Third, in response to the concerns that had emerged about the spaghetti bowl of rules, it became important to negotiate a regional agreement that would set regional standards and make it easier for there to for harmonized, established, common rules to be set across the region, preferably that reflected U.S. approaches and U.S. values. And fourth, the U.S. was hoping to build a coalition of like-minded countries that would help extend the rules across the region and beyond, eventually influencing discussions in the WTO and plurilaterally. All of these goals were embedded in TPP, but the agreement, as you all know, became controversial domestically and caught up in the 2016 election and was never ratified. Which brings us to the fourth major period, the Trump bilateral approach. The basis for President Trump's bilateral approach differed from the basis of the earlier period of bilateral approach. Trump saw the need to radically disrupt trade policy. But to do so, he saw going back to a bilateral approach as the best means to address what he saw was the failure of the U.S. government to use the leverage of its size and market power to advance America First interests. The administration sees bilateral trade deals as a means of addressing what it sees as unfair trade practices by most of our trading partners and the bilateral trade deficits that are the manifestation of this unfair trade. And the administration has used this approach, this bilateral approach, and the leverage that it brings with strategic rivals, with competitors, with allies and partners alike. The administration has said, once it withdrew from TPP, that it hopes to negotiate bilateral agreements with key TPP countries and other major economies. So far, however, the administration has only concluded an update of CORUS, the Korea-U.S. trade agreement, renegotiation of NAFTA, which is based in large part on TPP, and yesterday the announcement of the trade deal with Japan. The details of that deal, which is an initial deal, an early harvest, have yet to be released, but it appears to include two key elements. First, a market access deal that consists principally of Japan offering concessions on access to agriculture into its market and the U.S. providing certain concessions on industrial goods into the U.S. market from Japan. A second element of the agreement is on digital trade. Again, the text has not been released, but as I understand it, it reflects largely what was in the text of the U.S. MCA agreement on digital trade. Yesterday's press release from the White House also indicated that the two countries will conduct further negotiations to achieve a comprehensive trade agreement that results in more fair and reciprocal trade between the United States and Japan. So clearly the U.S. feels that there is more work to do to reach a fair trade agreement with Japan. There was nothing in the press release by the White House yesterday regarding the status of the 232 and the treatment of Japan under 232. So turning to the question as to whether the U.S. can articulate an effective bilateral strategy, I think that remains an open question. The U.S. has used its bilateral strategy under the Trump administration to elicit concessions from certain trading partners. This has brought some immediate benefits to some U.S. stakeholders whose issues are covered by the agreements. But the long-term vision for this bilateral strategy is difficult to identify. First, many countries observing the manner in which the U.S. has conducted negotiations with Canada, Mexico, Korea, and Japan have been circumspect about whether to seek negotiations with the United States. They are concerned that rather than establishing a win-win process, the deals could be zero-sum, and at the least, they would fall victim to the U.S. mercantilist approach. Second, even if countries were lining up to negotiate, the same questions that led the U.S. to question and largely abandon the bilateral approach a decade ago, both trade policy reasons and political reasons, remain. Third, and perhaps ultimately most importantly, other countries are continuing to negotiate their own regional and bilateral trade agreements, strengthening regional value chains and setting rules by which regional and global trade will be governed without the United States. While many of them prefer U.S. leadership and partnership, they will continue to pursue global and regional trade agreements that will promote trade and development and regional standards that reflect their interests. The conclusion of CPTPP after the withdrawal of the U.S. from TPP was evidence of that. A word on what this means for Japan and Taiwan. Japan has never been enthusiastic about negotiating a comprehensive bilateral agreement with the United States, or I shouldn't say never. Never since the U.S. withdrew from TPP, Japan has not been enthusiastic about negotiating a comprehensive bilateral agreement, always holding out hope that the U.S. would return to TPP or some version of it. In that regard, negotiating a limited agreement that did not touch on most of the rules that were in TPP might be considered somewhat of a victory. As to the market access deal that was negotiated, I have questions, as I'm sure the Diet will, but will reserve judgment until we see the full contents of the market access package and how and whether the agreement deals with the 232 issue. For Taiwan, I think the question is somewhat different. Taiwan is not a party to any regional trade agreement, and membership is probably unlikely in the foreseeable future. So a bilateral agreement with the United States would seem to be a good option. But here, too, political constraints would seem to prevail were the two countries to seek to negotiate a full-blown comprehensive FTA. It would then be for Taiwan to determine whether negotiating a smaller trade agreement with the United States is in its interests, and whether it could negotiate a smaller trade agreement that would help deepen U.S.-Taiwan relations, or whether doing so would serve to strain them at this turbulent time in the region. I will stop there, short of 10 minutes, and look forward to your questions.
Good morning, everyone. I'd like to thank Mireya and the Brookings for inviting me to participate in this very important, very interesting discussions. What I'd like to do is the following. I'd like to talk about three things. One is U.S.-China trade war. which is the one of the most, in my view, serious issues at the moment, and it has a lot of implications for the future of the global trading system and global economy. Number two, I'd like to talk about the U.S.-Japan trade deal. Oh, sorry, before that, I'd like to talk about Japan's trade policy, which has been quite different than the earlier ones. And then I'd like to end my talk by giving my views on U.S. trade deal, which has been pointed out by two previous speakers. First, on U.S.-China trade war. Here again, it's been discussed already, and there are at least two motives, in my view, for the U.S. to start this trade war. One is to improve the bilateral trade balance vis-à-vis China, and having a trade imbalance or trade deficit vis-à-vis China, in Mr. Trump's view, is a problem because it leads to unemployment in the United States. And the second reason or second motive behind this trade war is to deal with unfair trade practices by the Chinese government or Chinese enterprises, specifically forced technology transfer, violation of intellectual property, and so on. Then the question is whether these two motives or two objectives can be achieved by starting this trade war by the United States. In my view, to achieve the first objective, that is to correct imbalance, bilateral imbalance vis-à-vis China, protectionism or increasing imported tariff will contribute a little bit, but that does not really solve the basic problem. Here, United States, and maybe its trading partners, in this case China, they have to adopt the macroeconomic policies like monetary and fiscal policies which are more appropriate than a protection policy or trade policies. If you remember at the 1980s and 1990s, when the U.S. had a similar problem with Japan, vis-à-vis Japan, and what happened to the consequences of increasing tariffs by try to limit the U.S. imports from Japan, it didn't really work out the way U.S. wanted to see. We still have the U.S. trade deficit vis-à-vis Japan. So trade policy is not appropriate policy to deal with import deficit problem. What about the second objectives? Yes, I think it can have a quite an impact, but in my view, U.S. should cooperate with other countries, such as Japan and the EU, which face a similar problems in China. So, again, here, U.S. should not be just applying this kind of a bilateral or unilateral trade policy vis-à-vis China. Here, Japan and the EU can be a very effective cooperator. And then, this is what I wanted to say about the U.S.-China trade war. And we have already seen negative impacts of U.S.-China trade war, which is very serious. Global economic slowdown is taking place. And then, moreover, what I'm concerned is the possible breaking up of a world trading system. And that, of course, is likely to have a very serious problem for many years to come. I'd like to see U.S. change its policy stop this trade war. And then, of course, question is how can we stop this trade war? Maybe we'll be discussing this. Because of time, let me turn to the second subject that is a Japan's trade policy. Japan started to implement free trade agreement policy in the 21st century. Japan is one of the latecomers in this FTA trade policy circles. And Japan had a number of bilateral trade deals, beginning with Singapore, Mexico, Malaysia, and so on. And it was in 2013 when Japan joined TPP discussions, which were ongoing at the time. It took Prime Minister Abe quite a bit of effort to overcome the opposition from Japan, mostly in the agriculture sector. And Japan successfully entered negotiation, and then, in my view, U.S. and Japan cooperated very well to reach an agreement in 2015, was it, I think. Then, after that, as we heard earlier, U.S. pulled out of this TPP, and Japan acted very quickly with other countries like Australia to begin the TPP-11 negotiations. Japan was very instrumental in reaching an agreement among these 11 countries. And now Japan also was successfully achieving agreement with the EU, as Mireya mentioned earlier. Now, Japan is involved in RCEP negotiation, which involves 16 East Asian countries, and I think we'll be seeing some progress toward the end of this year, possibly reaching agreement this year. And so this is the Japan's new trade policy, and Japan was very keen on having free trade agreements for various reasons. One is because of the Japanese domestic economic situation. Population is declining, domestic market is shrinking, so we need to rely more on foreign markets. And one way to do it is to increase our market access to other countries. And FTAs can be a very important instrument for doing that. And finally, I have only two minute warning, so let me talk about the U.S.-Japan trade deal. And I was in Washington, so I didn't hear this news about the reaching, I guess, basic agreement. What I knew before was they reached an agreement in principle, whatever that means. Again, as far as I understand, U.S. wanted pretty much what they wanted, but Japan didn't get what they wanted. That's my assessment, simply put. Japan wanted what Japan did get from the U.S. In the TPP negotiation. That is elimination of tariffs on automobiles, Finnish automobiles, which is 2.5% tariff. It's a small tariff rate, but I guess we got the concession from the U.S. to remove this in, I don't know how many years, quite a long year, maybe 10 years or so, 12 years, 25 years, okay. But that Japan didn't get in this U.S.-Japan trade deal. Having said this, why Japan entered into negotiation with the U.S.? One, I think, view is that Mr. Trump used this threat very well. Unless Japan enters negotiation, we may invoke on this Section 232. And, of course, Japan try to avoid this because that will have a negative, very serious negative impact on Japan's exports of automobiles to the United States. The 2.5% tariff elimination is gone. But having said this, Japan was maybe feel a bit relieved because at least they hope that the U.S. will not embark the Section 232. But that, I'm not quite sure what Mr. Trump or U.S. authorities promised. I haven't seen that in writing. So it's very possible that Japanese wishful thinking will not be realized. That's what I'm quite a bit afraid of. Finally, one other point, which is the WTO consistency. According to the WTO rule, a trade agreement needs to at least have a 90% elimination of tariffs. Of course, you know, what is the definition of 90%? If we use this trade value, obviously that will not satisfy the U.S.-Japan deal will not satisfy this deal because about 30% of Japanese exports to the U.S. is automobiles. So that is, I think, issue to be discussed or to be discussed. Okay, let me finish with this. Thank you very much.
Okay, it's my pleasure to be here, and it's my advantage to be the last speaker because I don't need to mention too much. distinguished panelists, they talk about very much. And this is Taiwan. We are in the middle of giant elephants. And they have a trade war, China, Americans. And let me skip. Okay. Okay, let me start here. Let the trade war between China and Japan, the U.S., where's the point? Okay, maybe the first round, the second round, the third round, the tariff increased. I will emphasize more on what's the impact to Taiwan. And this is the growth rate of the U.S. imports from China. And the average growth rate is the gray line. It declined in the first half year of 2019. And the blue line is the tariff list, which is now on the list for additional tariff. It's still going, for the year growth rate annually. And the red one is declining. So it means that the tariff increase to its success to decrease from the Chinese export to the States. And from Taiwan's point of view, Taiwan is highly integrated in global supply chain, and we are the export and import is 145% of GDP in 2018, and Taiwan's economy has been affected by the global economy. And also, the trade tension between the States and China, the outcome of trade talks would affect global economic prospects. And U.S. China trade war hurts Taiwan on two ends. Taiwan depends on China because China is Taiwanese manufacturing base, and U.S. is the export market, especially for final goods like laptop, mobile phone, ICT products. And this will be on the list of the fourth round of the tariff increase. And the trilateral trade model for Taiwan is receiving order in Taiwan, but we manufacturing in China and shipping for American consumers, especially the iPhone 11, especially the components of iPhone and ICT product and the key components as well. And the U.S.-China trade tension will affect production and investment strategy for Taiwanese business model of trilateral trade. Let me introduce later. And under this one of tariff, it covers about $34 billion of Chinese import. And this too covers $16 billion of Chinese import. This is not focused on the final product. So the effect for Taiwan is only 0.21% of GDP. And Taiwanese companies, they deal with tariff by shipping product earlier before the tariff took into force. And the second major is transferring orders because the previously some orders to the Chinese factory and they transfer to the Taiwanese company and relocating production base in the long run. So for the these three additional tariffs on Chinese ICT imports in the $200 billion, which will start to impact Taiwan's export to China because the export goods decline and Taiwan's intermediate goods and the component will decline as well. Follow these four, an additional tariff on about 300 billion worth of Chinese imports, like ICT product, phone, laptop. This will start on December 15th. The demand declines as the price increases, the tariff effect. So these four has more significant impact on Taiwan's export for intermediate goods and consumption goods. So Taiwanese businessmen may adjust their production capacity to respond to U.S. tariff. Some industry were affected, but some business still benefit by delivering orders prior to tariffs or orders for production transfer from China to Taiwan. But in the long run, Taiwanese business will relocate their production base back to Taiwan or to South Asian countries, adjust from their over dependence on China. So this might be a good scenario for Taiwan. And the direct impact of Taiwan as a result of U.S.-China trade war, Taiwan's export to the United States clearly increased. It increased about 20.2% in the first half year of 2019. And almost half of U.S. import from China bear additional tariffs, so result in a sharp increase in the cost of Chinese imports. So for the first half year of 2019, the products on the list of tariff increase for Chinese imports, they have trade diversification effect. So the first one is Slovakia, it grew 1.1 times for the list on the tariff increase. This is trade diversification effect. And also Vietnam and Taiwan increased by 33.7%. And for Taiwan, it's 28.5% respectively. And export from France and South Korea also increased quite a lot. And this one is the component let me show the component of Taiwanese export goods similar to the additional tariff on Chinese export. The 19.7% is ICT product. So still for Taiwan, US is the second largest trade partner. And also for U.S., Taiwan is still the ninth largest trade partner. So let me stop here, and for the next turn. Thank you so much.
Thank you very much for excellent presentations. I have to say I'm also very impressed with how prompt everybody was. I don't think I've ever moderated a panel where everybody ends right on time. So that left a lot of time for us to engage in discussion. And it's my privilege to be the first to engage with the panelists and then later on to bring all of you. So let me then ask some questions. You all touch on these points, but I also want to emphasize them and then give an opportunity for the panelists to respond to one another and elicit a variety of views. And given that the U.S. and Japan have negotiated very, very quickly a bilateral trade deal, the expectation is that at the time of the United Nations General Assembly at the end of this month, the two leaders may be able then to jointly announce that at least the first stage is already taken care of. I would like to use that negotiation to think through about what does this bilateral turn, the Trump bilateralism, means for relations with Asia, specifically with Japan and Taiwan. So then what are the examples, what are the lessons and the precedents that are being set by this negotiation? First of all,
especially to Xu, but also to others. Xu mentioned that it's widely expected, and we all know that this is going to be a narrow agreement, that it's mostly tariffs, and that the most important economic sector in terms of bilateral trade flows, automobiles, is not going to be part of the tariff elimination exercise. So how will this be received in Japan? We know that Prime Minister Abe is very strong domestically, but can he sell this agreement as a win? How would then the pressure be if there is no specific statement on the 232? We don't know how that may come, but how do you think then the reaction from experts, from the public in Japan, may be to what we know might be and might not be in this agreement?
Okay, thank you very much. First of all, I thought this negotiation took longer than it looked like, because they had a TPP agreement, they meaning U.S. and Japan, agreed on many things in TPP agreement. And I thought before the beginning the bilateral talks, it would be very easy because, you know, what they know what they offered, and that's the last thing they can do. But that didn't happen. And I'd like to know why. Maybe you can tell me about the reason. But my kind of guess is that the Japan made it clear that Japan will offer, in other words, market access to Americans in the agricultural sector as much as Japan offered in the TPP agreement. So that was very clear. And Japan was hoping to get the same thing from the United States. That is what I said in my presentation, the elimination of 2.5% tariff on finished automobiles. But Japan didn't get it, right? So maybe this is one of the contentious issues which they discussed, and it took them longer than what I thought it. And also, U.S., my guess, wanted much more than what they get in agriculture market access in Japan than what they got in the TPP negotiation. Again, so these are maybe possible reasons why negotiations took longer than what I expected. And coming to this question about whether Japan won from negotiation, again, as I said in my presentation, Japan didn't get what Japan wanted initially, but over time, of course, Japan got this kind of assurance, maybe questionable, from the U.S. that the U.S. will not use Section 232, that is for national security reasons, put the additional tariff on imports from Japan, automobile imports from Japan. Because for Japan, they produce a lot of cars in the United States, but still, auto exports from Japan to the U.S. is a very large part of the Japanese economy. So Japan didn't get... I think Japan, in my view, is not so happy. Maybe a little bit happy because they feel a bit comfortable because U.S. will not use this Section 232. Maybe you can fill on this point.
I think that the negotiations of any bilateral agreement always takes longer than people think it's going to take. And in this case, there was not, I think, at the outset, a clear understanding between the parties as to what the parameters of the agreement were going to be, except as they agreed generally last fall in that joint statement between the two countries. And when the negotiations started, I think Japan tried to make clear that if the U.S. wasn't prepared to offer the market access that it had provided in TPP, then it would not reciprocate by offering the market access that it had offered the U.S. in TPP. And the political challenge of offering the same market access in agriculture was very clear. The market access package in agriculture in TPP consists of a number of elements. There is just tariff elimination that was provided by Japan and a number of agricultural products, but then there were quotas, and the quotas came in the form either of
country-specific quotas that were provided to each country, or TPP-wide quotas. So for those areas that were tariff cuts, it was easy for Japan to say, it doesn't matter to us if we offer you the same as we offer everybody else, because you can compete with the other TPP countries, and we don't have to go back to the Diet and explain that we've actually added more access. You know, we've opened our market additional to what we did in TPP. When it came to the quotas, however, there was something different there. In those cases where there were country-specific quotas, Japan would have to then go back to the Diet and explain, we are now offering new access to the United States, and here's what we got in return for it. And if it couldn't provide an adequate explanation of what it got in return, I think it would be difficult to open those quotas to the United States. In the case of the TPP-wide quotas, it would not be able to offer U.S. access to TPP-wide quotas unless it got the consent of the other TPP countries, and those TPP countries would not be likely to say, now that you've withdrawn, feel free to come in and share our quota. So I think Japan was in a difficult spot and had to adjust the market access in agriculture to reflect what the U.S. offer was, although we have yet to see exactly how that balance ended up. And we'll see how Japan is going to explain that to the Diet.
Okay, great. Let me then continue to tease out the broader implications of the potential U.S.-Japan trade deal. You're all seasoned trade experts and practitioners. What should we make of the fact that it's most likely that the first and third largest economy decide to negotiate a trade agreement that is not WTO consistent in terms of, you know, again, having this narrower reach and not liberalizing substantially all trade? What do we make about how this might impact the integrity of the multilateral trading system?
It is the U.S. that has to really deal with this issue. No, if my statement is correct, U.S. has to open up its auto market to satisfy 90%. It's not Japan which has to do something more than what they have promised to satisfy this condition.
I think as to your more general question, I think it's quite concerning. The U.S. has been at the forefront of developing the global trading system, advancing the multilateral interests since the 40s, since the 1940s, and I think there was a general consensus in the United States that not only was that leadership successful, but the U.S. had been one of the primary beneficiaries of that system. We have now put all of that into question. The U.S. has, at this point, not sought to explain whether or not how it views the consistency of this agreement with Article 24, the article in the WTO that says you have to achieve most trade in the trade agreement, and I think that for many in the administration, the question is moot because the dispute settlement system is now in question as well. If other countries sought to challenge the United States, it's not clear where they would go to challenge the United States. So the U.S. may feel that it has a free hand in doing this. But the bigger question is the long-term interests of the United States and the policies that we're pursuing and whether they're in our interest. We are now putting the U.S. in the position of challenging a system that has brought us great benefits and opening the door to other countries negotiating similar trade agreements that will continue to nibble away and undermine the trading system in a way that I think is not in our long-term interests. And I think it would be valuable if there were a more robust debate in the United States about this trade policy and its longer-term implications.
Mm-hmm. Very interesting. Xu and then Jinji.
Let me just add, I think, this is the one of the reasons why we need WTO reform. In other words, we are now talking about the WTO consistency rules and so on. But WTO itself has quite a few problems. We don't have time to discuss all of them, but say, for example, we talked about the unfair trade practices by Chinese. They are unfair trade practices, but there are no rules to govern, to regulate these practices at the WTO. So we need to really improve upon the mechanism of WTO, and this 90% rule is one of these problems. Another problem, for example, is treatment of developing countries. They are now treated especially differentially and so on. And many countries just claim themselves as developing countries. They may not be. So there are many issues. And one of them is this, GATT Article 24, which you mentioned. So we have to look at this issue from a broader perspective, what the global trading system should be and so on.
Jinji?
Jinji, I'm sorry. I think that your mic is not on. You want to
Okay. Yeah. My point is that if the U.S. and Japan trade agreement is implemented, it's almost the same as the U.S. rejoining CPTPP. Because Japan might be the linkage, Japan will become the linkage between the U.S. and other CPTPP member countries. When after Trump withdrew from CPTPP, from TPP negotiation, Japan and other member countries still going on and negotiate CPTPP. And the 11 member countries keep some flexibility in the main text of the CPTPP agreement for the U.S. to rejoin. So the outcome might be the same, because bilateral trade deal with from Japan and American, and the outcome is almost the same as the state go back to rejoin the CPTPP as well. So that's my point.
I see. Reactions from other panelists? Is this bilateral deal delivering similar results to what the CPTPP accomplished?
Well, what I'd like to point out is the it's a benefits of a regional agreement. TPP provided 12 countries as like a one common market, no borders and so on. And there's a rule called the cumulative rules of origin, which means that all the products which are produced within the 12 countries are treated equally. And if you have bilateral ones, you cannot use this so-called cumulative rules of origin rule. In other words, it's like hub and spoke system. U.S. is a hub, and all these other countries are the spokes. So if Japanese companies produce something in Vietnam using Japanese materials to be exported to the U.S., that does not qualify for free trade in a bilateral framework. But if we have 12 country region-wide TPP, this kind of trade transaction can be done tariff-free, which of course is much better for multinationals, companies which have supply chains throughout this region. So in my view, regional trade agreements gives much greater benefit than many bilateral ones, although the contents themselves are very similar.
Mm-hmm. Barbara?
Yeah, I agree with that. And I think that the visions are entirely different. The vision for TPP was to build a regional trade agreement that built supply chains, that brought together developed and developing countries and set standards again that, as I said earlier, that the countries hoped would eventually be reflected in WTO rules. There are issues in the WTO, I agree with that. There are issues on special and differential treatment. There are issues to do with state-owned enterprises and other
other competition issues. There are issues with dispute settlement. There are many issues that have been identified by WTO members, some of which the TPP countries together tried to begin to think through. Were they final solutions to any of those issues? No, they weren't. But I think that they were efforts on the part of the countries involved to begin to say, we need to collectively think through these problems and build the system. One of the areas, for instance, that I like to point to on special and differential treatment that has become a kind of contentious issue as of late in the WTO and a concern that the U.S. has expressed was something that was dealt with in the TPP in a unique way, and that is that everybody around the table understood that the countries that were party to the agreement were of differing levels of development. But they also agreed that everybody, all the countries, should commit to the same standards in the agreement. So Vietnam and Peru, as developing countries, as the least developed countries among the 12 countries, agreed to exactly the same standards as everybody else. But there was a recognition that there would need to be additional time provided to those countries to implement some of the commitments and capacity building provided by some of the countries to help them build the capacity in order to meet those commitments. Not that there would be some special and differential treatment in perpetuity, but a recognition that this agreement was going to exist for a very long period of time. So to give countries 2 or 3 or 4 or 5 years to come up to speed to develop the kinds of mechanisms and systems and domestic regulatory regimes that they needed to develop in order to implement high standard agreements was something that was in all of our interest. There hasn't been a full discussion of these kinds of issues in the WTO, but there was a vision and a way of thinking this through that I think is lacking right now.
Thank you very much. So we're covering a lot of ground. We're talking about global trade issues. We're talking about the bilateral issues. I want to talk about Taiwan's predicament and opportunities as well. But before I move to talk about Taiwan's trade policy and relations with the U.S., I want to touch on one last element of the U.S.-Japan negotiation that I think has wide repercussions for trade policy of the United States going forward, and that is the manner in which this exercise is to be conducted, that is, avoiding a vote by Congress. So we now have 3 years of America First trade policy, and we've seen really quite a breathtaking exercise of executive monopoly, I would even say, of trade policy. The decision to, in very unconventional ways, to use national security to then apply tariffs on aluminum steel, to threat tariffs on one of the largest economic sectors in the world, the automobile industry, to bring partners like Japan and the European Union to talk to us about trade, and then to negotiate bilaterally and tell Congress that because it's a tariff-cutting exercise, at least at this first stage, you will be notified, but you don't have to vote. So I remember, Barbara, at the time of the original TPP, there were so many intense and, of course, justified discussions about the legitimacy of trade policy, the idea to bring stakeholders, different inputs from society, certainly congressional oversight, and certainly having a balanced agreement with different branches of government, and certainly Congress front and center. But that doesn't seem to be the modus operandi today. So what does this mean for the future of U.S. trade policy? What does it mean for Japan, Shu, and potentially Taiwan if an agreement were to materialize, that the U.S. will have an executive agreement, whereas all the concessions that Japan gives to the United States will have to be approved by the Diet? So it seems to me that there's an important asymmetry there. We know that executive agreements can have a very short life span, and they can be easily set aside. So we're talking about risks, the risks that the United States down the line decides to impose 232 tariffs on automobiles, or the risk that, the executive agreement with Japan is set aside, how does that then impact the conduct of trade relations and more broadly relations? And how does Taiwan think about the fact that the United States is now moving forward with a more executive-driven trade policy without bringing Congress on board? So challenges here for us and challenges in how our Asian partners perceive the benefits of engaging in these negotiations. Barbara, if I can start with you.
Wow. I think that the challenges that you outlined are real. I would set aside the question of whether or not Japan has to put the agreement through the Diet and the U.S. doesn't, because many countries have their own processes for approving agreements, and it doesn't always go through countries' parliaments, so there is asymmetry in certain cases. And that, I think, is not so much the issue as the fact that, you know, by Constitution, under our Constitution, authority for trade is the responsibility, goes to Congress, and Congress has delegated that authority to the President, and now the President has taken executive action to negotiate these trade agreements in a way that Congress is allowing. After negotiating many trade agreements over many years, you might think that I would be somebody who would say, that's great, I would rather never have to deal with Congress and listen to Congress and all of the inputs that Congress has from all sides and competing views that you feel like you can never satisfy. But the truth is that as someone who has spent many years doing that, you develop a very healthy respect for the input that comes from that process and from the different views that are presented to you very aggressively by members of Congress. And I think there's something lost when you steamroll that process. I think that the question is not whether or not it's a valuable thing. I mean, I think for these agreements to have credibility and for there to be agreements that best advance U.S. interests, it's important that they are debated and considered carefully by Congress. That's not something that's happening here. And one wonders when members of Congress will begin to question the process. I think that the general assumption is because of the concerns of members of Congress about how the U.S.-China trade war has affected farmers, that Congress will not want to stand in the way of a trade agreement that is going to provide benefits to farmers, so that they will allow this agreement to go through, notwithstanding the concerns they have about the process. But one has to believe that there are many members of Congress now who are debating and quietly discussing how they are going to address this issue more broadly as the administration looks to negotiate other trade agreements. And I think it's about time.
Mm-hmm. Thank you. Any other comments on how does it look from Asia?
Well, you have to teach me. I mean, this is something new to me. I mean, you know, when you say executive agreement, and White House or the administration doesn't have to notify, or do they have to notify the Congress that they have reached an agreement? Mm-hmm. And in order to enact or in order to put this agreement into force, they don't need a ratification from the Congress. And why? Because it's the narrow coverage? Is that the reason? How do you define the narrow coverage, or, for example? I mean, I'm just, this is something, is there something new to begin with?
Yeah. And you think it's new because it had never really been used in this way, and Barbara here knows this subject much better than me, but there is a section in the Trade Promotion Authority that allows the President to engage in some, within limits, tariff proclamation, tariff reduction proclamation exercise. So I think that's what the route that the administration is anticipating to using, and is referenced in the statement yesterday.
Is it possible that the Congress challenges this?
Politically, I think it's doubtful because, as Barbara also was hinting at, American farmers are really suffering from all the disruption in the trade world. They are losing access to the China market. They are also very disadvantaged in the Japanese market, and the idea is that farmers require some kind of relief, and therefore leveling the playing field in the Japanese market is very attractive. So I think that I don't anticipate broad challenges to this specific deal, but in general, as Warren was also saying, we need to then step back and think about what is happening with the role of Congress in trade policy. Even though it's mandated by the Constitution, they seem to be more and more on the sidelines.
Well, again, since it seems to be a very new development, I guess if I were a Japanese government, I have to really study how it evolves over time. And if there's be no challenges from the Congress, you have to believe that you have to really trust, or you have to believe in what the executive agreement says. And so they put more emphasis on the Japanese government, or other government will put more emphasis on working with the administration rather than working with the Congress persons, I think.
Mm-hmm. Thank you, Shu. Any comments, Jinji?
Seems it's nothing related to Taiwan.
Okay.
But let me go back to the CPTPP that Taiwan is preparing for participating in CPTPP. I think after the U.S. withdrew from TPP, Japan did the trade agreement, and it's more inclusive than TPP. It's open to new members, and the country showing an interest to join CPTPP include Taiwan, South Korea, Indonesia, Philippines, Thailand. And those countries, and CPTPP members are all important trading partners of Taiwan. And it accounts for about 30% of Taiwan's export and 40% of imports. And Japan, South Korea, Australia, New Zealand, and ASEAN country. It's also quite helpful for Taiwan's implementation of Taiwan's new southbound policy. It will expand and the expansion of Taiwan's export markets. So we are preparing to join CPTPP. And also, Taiwan is overlapped with the free and open Indo-Pacific Ocean geopolitically. The Security Diamond Area Framework among U.S., Japan, India, Australia, and Taiwan is in the central area of the Security Diamond Framework. So for Taiwan, it's also an excellent opportunity to achieve economic transformation and adjust foreign trade development.
Thank you, Ajinji. So let me then switch more directly to a conversation about Taiwan's trade policy choices in this world of upheaval with the U.S.-China trade war. As you mentioned in your presentation, there are some opportunities. There's been a coming back of many manufacturing firms to Taiwan, and economic ties with the United States are also in very good track. I think that this administration, the Trump administration, has really elevated the relationship with Taiwan, at least on the security front. But what may be still lacking is on the trade front in terms of giving the green light to a bilateral trade agreement. Part of it, I think, has to do with overload. As Vera was saying, when you negotiate bilaterally, there's only so much you can undertake. And when you are taking on China in this manner and also negotiating with Japan and trying to get the USMCA agreement passed through Congress, there's limits there. But my sense, Jinji, and I would really appreciate if you can elaborate on this, is that it's not just a question of finding space in the agenda and finding legs to this policy, but that in some ways the reluctance of the U.S. economic agencies, USTR, Commerce, to really push forward with the bilateral trade agreement is still there. That the traditional market access irritants in beef, for example, and so forth, have not been eliminated, and that there's still the notion that Taiwan needs to address these questions as a precondition to launch negotiations and not as items that would be dealt with as part of the negotiations. So reading the politics of the United States, but in particular also the politics of Taiwan that you obviously follow much more closely, what are the chances of a bilateral trade negotiation starting between these two countries, or these two nations?
Okay, so let me start from the U.S.-China trade war. I think it's still a long way to go because the dispute is not only limited in the trade, but also expand to technology and some global standard competition protocol. And this makes it difficult for both countries to make a whole deal. especially taking into account that in the technological competition, Taiwan is still playing an important role in the global supply chain, especially in semiconductor and ICD production. So I suggest that Taiwanese government encourage a non-China or China-free supply chain. Because many Taiwan businessmen, they are returning from China to set up new production in Taiwan to avoid the additional tariff imposed to the Chinese export. As this happens, the global supply chain will start to change. So I think as the global supply chain change and Taiwan should take this good chance that to make Taiwan integrated in the if Taiwan do not make the chance, Taiwan still integrated in the race supply chain. So we make components, we make key technology, but export to China, to Huawei or to Samsung. And this standard is quite different from the United standards. So for rebalancing strategy is quite critical for Taiwan to join CPTPP or to negotiate a bilateral trade deal with the United States. If Taiwan fail to join CPTPP or not to make a bilateral trade, more further economic integration with the states or the global supply chain, it's a pity for Taiwan because Taiwan will be blocked by tariff barrier and Taiwan's economy might be marginalized or even encounter risk of becoming subordinated to the Chinese economy because Taiwan have alpha with the China economy. So Taiwan might be the spot and China will be the hub. So it's quite dangerous for Taiwan.
Thank you so much. So time is going fast and it's time to bring you all to the conversation. We have mics that are going to be in the room. So if you can please raise your hand and identify yourself and ask a short, concise question, I would appreciate it. So questions. I see someone in the back.
Hi, thank you. David Lauder with Reuters News Service. This is mainly a question for Professor Urata. Going back to the U.S.-Japan trade deal, this initial tranche of it, I guess, what we do understand is that it does not include the auto sector at this time. Just wondering...
Could you speak up a little bit? Sorry.
Sorry. Just... regarding the trade deal, the fact that it's not likely to include autos, do you anticipate, though, that Japan would ultimately have to accept some kind of a quota on auto exports to the United States in order to completely eliminate the threat of 232 tariffs?
I hope that will not be the case. I mean, quota is something that... Japan like to, of course, avoid. If I understand correctly what happened to USMCA, there is a quota set, which is quite far, I guess, over the existing number of cars being imported from Mexico and Canada. And then that quota, if I understand correctly, is the threshold. And after you reach the threshold, then you may get the additional tariff. Is that the... it's not really quota, is it? If that is the case, maybe Japan had no choice but to accept it. But again, of course, Japan had a very bad experiences in the past, which is called voluntary export restraint, which is actually a quota. And that really had very serious impacts on Japanese car producers. And again, I'm quite sure that Japan like to see that. I mean, like to avoid that kind of situation.
If I can jump into this discussion, Shu, my understanding of that provision in the USMCA, the way I read it, is an insurance policy, and that is that were the United States to go forward and impose that national security tariff, then Canada and Mexico can export to the United States 2.4 million vehicles still duty-free. So it's like you take insurance policy in that case. Worst-case scenario. I think your question really, if I were to boil it down, is which of two poisons would Japan like to take? And the answer, I think, is none. And the Japanese government has been very open about calling those red lines. So I think it would be a serious problem if Japan, the Japanese government, were pushed hard. And my sense is that they've given a lot on agricultural issues and so forth, but they're not willing to go for a quota, and they would like to have a reassurance on the 232. The question is, what form would that reassurance be, and is it really a good guarantee or not? A general statement or something within the body of the text, preferably, of course, I think from the point of view of Japan, in the text. I am not sure that the stars are aligning for that, but we have to wait and see the actual text. I have two questions here.
Hello. My name is Elliot Hurwitz. I want to thank the panel for an excellent presentation. I'm a retired person who worked at the World Bank for 20 years and in the intelligence community as well. This presentation is on America First, and protectionism has been mentioned. In the context of that, I would like to look back to the Smoot-Hawley tariffs of the 1930s and the effect of protectionism at that time, and ask the panel, what are the implications for the future?
So new protectionism, the implications of the new protectionism.
Right. Of course, as you mentioned, in the pre-war period, beginning with Smoot-Hawley, I think, protectionist policy, which led to so-called tariff war at the time. Many countries, U.S., European countries, they raised tariff in order to protect their industries, which are suffering from global, you know, recession, global depression. And as a result of raising tariffs and also so-called competitive depreciation of the currencies, that led to decline, huge decline in the global trade, which means huge decline in production, a lot of unemployment. Countries including Japan, Germany, and other countries, they are suffering from this serious depression, recession. You know what happened afterwards. World War II, countries...
The Depression also happened.
That's a depression, Great Depression, which was exacerbated by all the trade policies, protectionist policies, and which led one of the, according, you know, there are several, of course, many views as to what are the causes of World War II, but one reason is this, you know, Great Depression and the protectionist policies, which made it worse. And so countries like Japan, they need their market to sell their markets abroad, and one of, you know, the ways that they did it to advance into the countries. And then that's something that we have to avoid. I think we have a much better situation because of a better global trading system. And, of course, you know, the GATT General Agreement on Tariffs and Trade is established because of these, try to avoid the, you know, occurrence of such devastating situation.
Thank you. So now we continue here, and then I'll go to that side of the room.
Thank you. Thank you. Jean-François Boitin, I'm the MEDEF French business representative in the U.S. And I have two questions. One about the digital chapter, assuming that it's the same as what's in the USMCA, and assuming that USMCA gets ratified, in legal term, what's the difference between a treaty that has been ratified by Congress and an executive agreement? And my second question is about Taiwan, because assuming that Taiwan relocates production in Taiwan or as other supply chains in Vietnam, what guarantees do you have that increasing your surpluses or Vietnam surplus with the U.S. won't get exactly the same result as a China trade war, i.e. tariffs on Taiwanese exports or on Vietnamese exports? And is Taiwanese business worried about that, or they don't care?
Let me start with the question on the digital trade agreement. I think that the administration's approach is that because the digital trade agreement does not require change of any laws in the United States, it's moot whether or not Congress has a say. So that the agreement was completed between the U.S. and Japan. Japan may or may not have to make any changes. I think that it was drafted in a way so that the Japanese hope they will not have to make any legal changes, although it will have to go through the Diet. But in the United States, since there are no legal changes required, it will have no effect. And then the question becomes, what are the implications for dispute settlement? It's not clear there is dispute settlement in this deal altogether. So that would be an omission that you would see in a more comprehensive deal.
Excellent.
Okay. I think the trade structure between ASEAN country and the States is mostly in final goods. And at the same time, its trade with Taiwan is more on trade in parts, in components. That's why I always say Taiwan's trade to the state is make the U.S. supply chain much stronger. So if this trade pattern because the ASEAN country has caused U.S. trade deficit, the ASEAN country around 11.54% of total U.S. trade deficit. So U.S. can cut its trade deficit with ASEAN countries. How to do that is to invest more in Taiwan, in those sectors, which, because U.S. has competitive disadvantage with ASEAN countries, but Taiwan has competitive advantage in ASEAN countries. So if you invest in Taiwan and Taiwan have a competitive advantage, and this will cut the trade deficit of states with the ASEAN countries.
Thank you. So let me switch a little bit to this side of the room, and then I'll come back to you as well. So this lady here in the third row.
Thank you. My name is Deborah Ray, and I'm a graduate student at the University of Maryland. My question is in regards to Taiwan. So I feel at the center of this issue is supply chain security, especially with the Huawei controversy. What is Taiwan willing to bring to the table in trade negotiations to better secure the supply chain for national security in the U.S.?
Yeah, I understand the security of the supply chain. Because Taiwan suffered quite a lot, many Chinese factories, they hire Taiwanese people. They set up many hay hunters in Taiwan, and they hire the Taiwanese people with the same salary, but in different dollars. In Taiwan, they receive new Taiwan dollar with only quarter of the RMB. If you want to join the factory in the red supply chain, I will give you the same amount, but in RMB, which is four times. So many Taiwanese, some Taiwanese, they go to the Chinese factory, especially in the technology sector. And this really hurt Taiwanese supply chain, because the red supply chain, they will take over Taiwanese supply chain. They do not care so much about the patent, the property, intelligence property as well. So for Taiwan's point of view, we want to divide two different supply chain. One is for red supply chain, and which Taiwan rely quite a lot on the Chinese market. And Taiwan will try to develop another non-China-free supply chain for the states, for the EU countries.
Thank you. We had a question with this gentleman, and then I see another hand on the back.
Hello. Hi. Yeah, my name is Richard Lemmer. I'm an investor, and I'm just wondering, a little bit of a devil's advocate question, if you don't mind, because there was some mention of long-term benefits. A couple quick questions. Long-term benefits, long-term interests of the United States. And it's in this day of kind of fake news and whatnot, I find it very difficult to see evidence-based issues around these things like trades, like counterclaim. What kind of long-term interests should we really be concerned about? is one question. The other question is, you know, Japan gave up so much in agriculture, but given the demographic, you know, shifts in Japan, is that really that much of a change? And then as it relates to Taiwan, how should we look at a prominent businessman now running for government there? And what are those implications?
Okay, so what should be the long-term interest of the United States trade policy or Asia policy? How demographics impact on Japan's trade policy and agriculture? And then, if I understood correctly, what should an investor do in Taiwan? Okay. All right.
On the long-term interest, I think that there had been a consensus that trade agreements and liberal trade policies had promoted growth and development in the United States across sectors and had contributed to economic growth over the last 70 years. And I think that's evidenced by the data. The United States increasingly went from looking at very narrow trade agreements that looked at goods to broader trade agreements. So the negotiations went from just tariff to understanding that we had to do single undertakings that covered a broad range of agreements so sectors across the economy would benefit. If services sectors were of increasing importance to the United States, then agreements included increasingly efforts to open markets around the globe in services. So we had then goods and services. But then there was an understanding that in order for those benefits to accrue, agreements also had to look at other attendant issues. If you could get your goods in, were the customs regimes open and fair? Were intellectual property rights being protected? Were competition policies in effect that would allow you to compete? And across the range of the agreement, additional issues began to be added to agreements over time to ensure that those benefits would be realized. Over time, I think that the United States has benefited from these liberal trade policies, not just in terms of increased trade, but in terms of those supply chains that have allowed us to compete globally. Now, when you come back and you look at the United States and the debate that's taken place on trade in the United States, I think part of that debate, and this is my personal view that I spend a lot of time thinking about, is that when people are looking at trade agreements and you're debating a trade agreement, you aren't saying, have these open policies contributed to growth and development in the United States and a higher standard of living and more choice and all of the things that we say that we promise through a trade agreement. What people say is trade has caused a particular job loss, or trade has caused these various things that agreements are accused of. And I think part of that comes from the fact that we're not arguing trade agreements are the panacea for all economic problems that we have. What we're saying is trade agreements contribute to our efforts to promote growth in the United States. But trade agreements have to work in tandem with other economic policies that get at distribution issues, that get at retraining issues and education and all of the range of issues that contribute to our economic growth. But I think the evidence is clear that trade policies that have been followed over the past 70 years have contributed to growth in this economy and around the world.
Thank you. So we have 1 minute left. So if you have very short comments, and I know there was one last question, maybe after we finish, if you don't mind coming to the front, and I'm sure that you can engage with the panelists if they're generous.
Sorry. I just want to echo what she said. In long term, we know, you know, from the experiences that the globalization, expanded trade and investment contributed to high economic growth in the post-war two period. But the problem is a short-term kind of adjustment. Of course, you know, you have to apply appropriate policies to deal with the short-term adjustment problems. It's called kind of inclusive growth. I mean, people do suffer from this adjustment. We need to provide assistance, necessary, appropriate assistance to deal with that. That's the first point I wanted to make on Japan. Yes, I'm in favor of opening up agriculture market even more in Japan because partly because of demographic changes. We need human resources, workers, to be employed in a productive sector, we should really move people and money, I guess, from agriculture sector, which is not competitive, to more competitive sector. By doing so, we can expect our agriculture sector to be more competitive.
Thank you. Jinji, last words?
I'm a little bit nervous on the stage, so maybe I discuss with you later.
I'm sorry, think again. You
want to
borrow mine?
I think it's long. Yeah. Okay. Yeah, I'm a little bit nervous on the stage, so maybe we discuss later. Thank you.
All right, well, thank you so much all for your comments and questions, and please join me in thanking the panelists for an excellent presentation today.